cultural education. What about chemistry? Isn't chemistry about culture too? Don't we have cultures of teaching? Don't we have different cultures? Aren't different epistemologies also related to different cultures? So it was a very intense debate. And actually, the first year we didn't teach it because teaching intercultural education was even associated with specific political views as it regards to the Cyprus problem. In a way, it was interpreted to be a less patriotic stance, since this opening to the otherness was seen as a way of the opening up proposals for bicommunal projects with Turkish Cypriots, which projects today are considered to be very popular and well respected. But even 8 years ago, they were considered to be unpatriotic, to say the least. Now, the third thing about this teacher training program is that when it was introduced at the University of Cyprus, it was the first time that actually teachers, I'm talking about secondary school teachers, demanded a course in intercultural education. So it's very interesting, this coming together of this desire for intercultural projects. And another thing, which is the fourth thing, which is quite problematic in this coming to desire intercultural education, is that this desire replicates, reiterates always the other as the object of study, as the object of culture, as the bearer of culture. At the same time we study, we represent others, we empty ourselves as the subjects of study from any cultural content. We are not cultural, and others are becoming, to play with Giorgio Agamben's term, homo sapiens, the others are just becoming, again, homo culturus. They matter just because they are trapped into culture. So now, what actually wanted to do, that was my own aporia and my own problematic, how to teach about the difference culture makes for some people and at the same time avoid these traps of exoticism of culture and exoticism of others. So this is the pedagogical problematic which brought me to GEARS. Now, something about some of the other theoretical aspects of this project, post-structuralism first. Derrida is very important to my work. And one of the things that Derrida has been saying very early in his work, and I think one of the things we all of us missed until he started very recently, the last years of his life, writing about cosmopolitanism and hospitality, all of a sudden then all of us discovered the political Derrida. Well, Derrida was political all along. For example, let's talk about what he says about the sign. What Derrida says about the sign is that the sign is arbitrary, but at the same time, it's not capricious. For example, take colors, black and white. Derrida says there is no white, there is no black. There is just difference between white and black, and it's exactly with this difference which makes us understand what is white and what is black. So the sign is based on difference. Now, the counter-argument is, you're fine, but some of us are white, but that's what we believe, another mythology, and some people are black. And that's a real difference which makes other kinds of, produces other differences in the political sphere. What about that, Derrida? Well, Derrida didn't address such kinds of questions, but I believe enabled us to ask other kinds of questions exactly by exposing the capriciousness, the arbitrariness, but not the capriciousness of the sign. So what I mean by this non-capriciousness of the sign, Derrida helps us to think that our emphasis on blackness, which we thought was a very interesting academic project, deconstructing blackness, studying blackness, attitudes for blacks, and so on, was very problematic because we had ignored that whiteness was also constructed. So, for example, this is one of the cases where post-structuralists can help us start asking other questions, not questions about blackness, but questions, genealogical questions, for example, about whiteness. Now, let me take you to another theoretical source for this project, a project which I haven't explained yet and I'll be doing pretty soon, Toni Morrison. I don't know if you are familiar with the work of Toni Morrison. Quite a few of her works have recently been translated to Greek as well. In her, one of her more political works of hers, Playing in the Dark, published in 1991, Toni Morrison shows that the development of the national characteristics of the American fiction, individualism, masculinity, the thematics of innocence always coupled with an obsession with figurations of death and hell, social intervention versus historical images, is actually, these binaries are always enabled by something which is there and is never spoken, blackness. So what do we do with blackness? Toni Morrison is writing actually at a time when the wars about the canon start in the States. For example, everybody wants to put their own authors in the curriculum. Minorities press for Latin, Latinos, blacks push for black writers, women push for women authors, and Toni Morrison says, yeah, that's not enough. We can put some black writers in the canon, but not enough. It's not a question of inversing the relationship. It's not just a matter of taking the racialized object, black, and reconstituting them as a non-racialized subject, authors, for example. What we have to do, Toni Morrison suggested, is that we need to do something else as well. We need to pay attention to the racializing subject. So pretty much what she said in that work on Playing in the Dark, quoting from her, I came to realize the obvious. The subject of the dream is the dreamer. My project, she writes, is an effort to avert the critical gaze from the racial object to the racial subject, from the described and imagined to the describers and imaginers, from the serving to the served. So what I will do in the next part, I will just take show some points from Gears, but before doing that, let's play a bit with these machines of gazing here, which PowerPoint makes feasible for us. Yodalisk. I forgot to mention Said, yeah, of course. How could you do multicultural work without engaging in Said? Said, of course, and that's kind of one of the weaknesses of his works, he has these very strict binaries between objects and subjects, the West and the East. And he doesn't pay enough attention to variations within the West, reflexivity within the West. For example, the West, which produced the Odalisk, also produced the Olympia. And what we have, for example, in the case of Olympia, which is quite an inversion, whereas here we don't have the black is absent, blackness is absent, but it's absent because it doesn't even have access to the room. Here, we move from the object, the female object, to the female subject, and just look at her, the way she gazes back. You desire her. She doesn't say anything, she's just sitting there, she's there. She's not there. She's asking you, she's desiring you. Do you want me? Come and get it. Of course, by foregrounding the female subject, what happens is that another woman becomes the background figure. So again, we have this relationship, this dialectic of power. And this is another work of art back in the 70s, Larry Rivers, I Like Olympia in Blackface, where Rivers takes that subject-object relationship further. We take like a closer look at that. Here we have a first reversal. When I use this slide with my students, they say, oh my God, I realize that's not a woman, that's a man. And I say, no, it's a woman. They're different kind of women. Or at least tropes of painting, sometimes even tropes of photography, use a different kind of economy when they depict the sexuality of objects. If a man and is in a colonized state, we used to treat him like a boy. And if it's a woman, it's just less of female. What we have here is that we have light on the black figure. So the black figure enters again the economy of voices, politics. And at the same time, we have an erasure of the white woman. But if you go to the next picture, you even have more erasures, because here what's happening, Larry Rivers shows in this view that you can also be, you can be both the subject and the object of desire. You can be desiring and desirable. So it's not just positions of subject and object. So your question might be, where do you go with this? So let me come to Geertz and why I find Geertz interesting. Geertz has been attacked. This is not the time to write about Geertz. What Geertz tried to do in his 73 essay, Thick Description Towards an Interpretive Theory of Culture, was to put culture on the stage and tell us, don't take culture too seriously. Culture doesn't exist as an object. Culture consists of multiple layers and structures of meaning, and you can enter the structures of meaning from different points. So to make that play visible to us, he gives the following examples. Probably you're familiar with this distinction he makes between wink and twitch, but let me try to reiterate that. He says, imagine two boys. That's very interesting. All philosophers or anthropologists, when they come to theory, the subjects are always boys. Well, let's say we have two boys, and both of them move the eyelids of the right eye. And he says, probably from a camera's viewpoint, they both appear to do exactly the same thing, the phenomenal position. There is no difference between them. But he says there is an enormous difference between the two, because what actually the first one is doing is just a twitch. You know, it's like a neurological reaction. There is no meaning to that. There is no depth to that. There is no intention to that. And above all, there is no audience to that. There is no community. It's just a single behavior. Take the second one, he says. He's not just twitching. He's winking. And to wink, you need to have purpose. You need to have desire. You need to have subject. You need to have object. You need to have a community which shares a specific code. And you need to have a code. And Geertz goes on and on and on and on. He says, it's not just that. Now imagine somebody who sees the first one who is winking, and he's also winking just to make fun of the person who is winking. Or take a different example, just to make, perhaps make this example, third example, more visible, like repeating the wink just to make it more visible and have fun of that and parody that. I don't know if you have children, but one of the things children do is to imitate us all the time. They say, for example, Eva is going to sleep. And actually, that's not a twitch, it's a wink, it's a code, you know, it's tone of voice, the time you say that, how you say it, how you stand when you say it. And then Eva goes like that. Eva is time to go to sleep, you know. She repeats that, but she parodies that. Or perhaps imagine Eva standing in front of the mirror and trying to imitate her mother so that she knows how to fight back. So what Geertz is saying, that all we have is not ontological specs of culture, but the structures of meaning. And somebody could go back and say to Geertz, okay, it's all meaning, but you don't talk about causality. And in fact, Geertz doesn't talk about causality, and he's not interested about causality. He's not interested, for example, who is causing something, who has power, and who doesn't have power. They're just signs and users of signs. What I find though very interesting in Geertz, and I'll just go ahead and give an example about that, is that he himself recognizes that risk, the danger that cultural analysis, he says, can run into in this search for the deep, 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 deep meaning, is that it can just become like a conspiracy theory. So what we have to do, he says, how do we study things about power, inequality, structures? Well, he says, from the very first beginning, it has to do with the way we frame our objects of study. So what we are doing here, we are, in this course, we are trying to frame from the beginning the object of intercultural study in a way that the conflict itself, that power itself, is already the study of investigation, so we don't study the others. What we study is we study the encounters between others and us in context of an equal power. And what I do with my students, and this is strategic, and I would like to hear your comments about that. Perhaps it's unethical, perhaps it's good, it's useful. My response is that it's productive. It makes them sensitive. I start by showing to them some twitches and winks, or winks mistaken for twitches in the context of the colonial encounter. Let's take, for example, this excerpt from Dixon's British Cyprus, 1879, writes Dixon about Cyprus. And I bet there are many anthropological readings like that about Malta as well, Middle East countries, the Orient in general. What are the Cypriots? Except in name, they're neither Turks nor Greeks. Neither are they an amalgam of these two races. In neither face nor figure, in neither speech nor genius does the Cypriot any resemblance to either Turk or Greek. Nowhere have I seen a Turkish figure. I don't know what he was looking for. Nowhere a Grecian profile, and I haven't seen a Grecian profile all my life living in Cyprus. I don't know what that says about me as a woman or Cypriots as a Greek man. Here we're speaking of the race and not the Greek. Who then are the Cypriots? Do they still not part one of those underived primitive stocks which spring from the soil and have no history elsewhere? What they are, they were, and what they were, they are. An indolent, careless, mimetic people, but without a spark of Turkish fire, without a touch of Grecian taste. So, always anthropology, and that's the problem with anthropology, has served this colonial project, and writers like Dixon were always already behaving like anthropologists, writing from a native perspective. So you might ask me now, if Geertz is revisiting again the native point in analyzing, because to understand the wink, you must get into the culture, so you have to identify with the native viewpoint, which means that you really buy into this ideology that there are natives. Well, let's follow how Dixon studies the natives. And this is an example he has conversation between a native. I don't know if Kirachi means anything in Maltese or in any other language, but in Cyprus, actually, Kirachi, today this word doesn't exist, but in the dialect, Kirachi is the person who leads the animals, like the donkeys, if you are carrying things. So he asks the person, the native, "What's your name, Kirachi?" Lifting up his eyes in wonder, not in pique, the lad, well, male people are always either boys or lads in these conversations, replies to me, "Kirachi, no, excuse me, that's your trade, mule driver, donkey driver, Kirachi. What I ask you is your name." The lad seems puzzled. It's difficult for him to separate his calling from his name. "You have another name at home. Your father doesn't call you Kirachi." He sees it now and sparkles up. "Musa. He calls me Musa." "Good. What does he call himself?" "Kirachi." "No, no, no, I mean his name. What does your mother call him?" "Yakub." "And where do you come from, Musa?" "Athienu." "All Kirachis come from Athienu." "Yes, I know. What I want to know is where you came from first." You might now, blinding this guy, ask, what kind of question is this, you know? "Long, long ago, where did the black Kirachis come from first?" And he says, "Out of the ground." "Oh my God," said one of my students when we engage into a kind of thick description of that, "he didn't get it." What he meant, Musa Kirachi, was from here, Pudame, if you phrase that in plain Cypriot dialect. He was pretty much saying, "I'm from here," which was translated to mean "out of the ground." So this is how we start with our students. We want to show that there are actually winks. What he was doing, the Kirachi, the mule driver, was to wink. like from here, which means the geographical, topographical, indexical sign, which was actually mistaken for a tweet. I'm like out of the soil, person without meaning, without culture, without anything. So what we do in these things, instead of focusing and trying to, what I say, pull the hair of natives and just trying to show that Musa had some original culture which the British didn't see. Or look into the British and say, look how they gaze, who that they look at the hegemonic eye. What we're actually trying to do is what actually gets missed in this kind of encounters, what we lose, and perhaps what we should study. So in the having played with some of these semiotic examples in the class, what the teachers, philologists, chemists, biologists, theologians have to do is to come up with their own episode. So part of the assignment is to write, catch an episode and describe that episode in a way that shows that what happens always in unequal encounters, if a wink is mistaken for a tweet or a tweet is mistaken for a wink, is something more than accidents of interpretation. It's more like a mechanics of power. It's more like a semiotics which comes to normalize relations of power. And just let me share a little example from you. These actually are the second draft of these students. They have to give a first draft where basically they say, well, I want to study the culture of Greek Cypriot in London. So they insist, they want to focus on the object, on the community. And I said, no, that's not enough. You have to focus on an encounter. We're not interested in the culture of people, we are interested in the culture of encounter. So this is a kind of dialogue which is very hard to translate in English because it's already polyglot, because some of it is in Greek dialect and some of them in Cypriot dialect and some of it is in Cypriot English and some of it is in English because it takes place in a Cypriot school in England. And so they use the book, the textbook, which has been produced to elevate the Christian Orthodox spirit of the diaspora. This is in a way a comment about all this kind of romanticism about diaspora. There are many problems with diasporas as well, especially when they are regulated by the nation state. Actually, nationalism and ethnocentrism is much stronger in the diaspora than in the center because it's assumed to be borderline culture, so it needs protection. So if you want to look for Greek nationalism in school, you shouldn't go to the metropolis, you shouldn't go to Athens, you shouldn't go to Cyprus. You should probably go to London. So they read the text and the teacher asks, why does Vasula like to go with her father to Harrogate? And Katerina says, because there are many Greeks there. And then another student jumps in and says, Maria, oi, oi, miss. No, miss. That's a lie. In epsema. And then galondo Harrogate. Harrogate is no good. Teacher, γιατί Μαρία μου? Why Maria? Maria replies, έχει πολλούς Ινδιάνους. There are many Ινδιάνοι there. And all the class starts laughing. Yes, miss. There are many Ινδιάνοι. And the teacher tries to clarify, what do you mean because there are many Indians there? Or people from India? And the student says, no, they are Indiani and they are disgusting. So basically what's happening in this scenario here, the students are quite multicultural, quite caught into the depths of culture. They are producing these new idioms like Indiani, that is not such a term either in Greek or in English, which actually conflates the American idiom of, you know, the exotic image of Indians riding horses naked and the idea of the colonized people of India into a singular term, Indians, which Indiani, which she treats as a natural word, as a word which names something which actually exists. So what follows, and I don't have time to translate it, is actually what the class is doing, is they are engaging into a kind of critical genealogy of these terms. How we ended up Cypriots having such a derogatory word as Indiani. People who share common colonial history with India, for example, how we end up using such a word to repeat racial idioms and racist acts. I don't know if I have 1 minute to give another example. Another example, a student comes up and says, well, I want to study the history of migrants from Egypt in my class. So he comes and brings on a draft, and I say, no, that's not enough. What you need is to go back and find how the semiotic structures, well, that's not how I say that, but dialogues between your students and the migrant students from Egypt and find what's going on. So they come back and they make this script which talks about one of the commonest words we use in these references is chtigaris. Well, I don't know how to translate that, but chtigio in Greek means both disease, the bearer of disease, and also dirty person. And it's very interesting. I said, well, what are you going to do about this racist discourse? And he says, well, no. I have to teach them how to respect the Egyptian migrant students. And I said, well, before you do that, perhaps you want to turn back to the Cypriot students and find out how they came up with these words. So in a way, engage in a critical genealogy of our own culture, of our own racist tools, where they originate, and how they come to be normalized. And going back into the critical genealogy of Chtigaris, finds out, for example, that the two first colonial laws which passed in Cyprus were not about education, were not about culture, were not about politics, were about dogs and lepers. Both laws were passed the same day, the second year of English rule. The first law about dogs pretty much said that if you have a dog, your dog has to have a collar. It took actually 20 years to transform that and implement that into educational policy. If you are going to be a student or a national subject, you have to be either Muslim or Christian in this country. Now, about the law about lepers, it was the first law that ever passed Cyprus about lepers, established the lepers farms, which were actually located outside main cities. We still have those farms. Actually, there are still, we found two of those people in the context of this project. We are living in the lepers farm. And we came to find out why the person with the gaze uses the word chtigaris in the racist way they use it without even knowing that. And one of my students said, that's very interesting, but it sounds like X-Files. No, they're out there. There is always something wrong in language. And I say, yeah, language is not innocent. And she says, but students don't know that. They don't know the origin of language. And I reply, but they do know its power, and they use it. Thank you.
Thank you, Celia. Lots of issues raised about identity, about the gaze, about politics of language, language and power. I'm sure you've got some questions to ask. We'll just take a few questions. I'm sure Celia will be prepared to answer them. So, who'd like to go first?
Thank you for your very interesting presentation. I want to know, when you engage in this dialogue with your students, do they have an opportunity to think about it, bring it back, and have you heard anything about what they've done in their classes or what kind of impact this type of reflection has had?
Just to make the politics, the pedagogical politics of this approach more visible. What we're trying to do is actually work along with James Vance and move from the, you know, incorporating something in the curriculum about others to go back and think more critically about our own identities, how they are productive. So when it comes to actual assignments, if you look in Tumbanks, it's moving from stage 2 to stage 3, when in reality it takes a whole semester to do that, because you actually have to deal with two issues at the same time. You have to deal with the definition of culture, because we think about culture, we think one people, one group, and what they do, and we're trying to go away from that and say, no, there are multiple cultures, but culture is what we do with codes. We are not our cultures. And it takes a lot of work, because they come back with the first draft, and you have to say, go back and rethink again. Perhaps you miss some details. And usually what they do in the first draft, they have the tendency to psychologize people. Like, you either have the Cypriot students who are always depicted to be very racist, and then you have the poor objects of racism. So they get into this emotional kind of discourse, and you have to say, no, go away with pop psychology. And then they come back with pop sociology. We have to change society and we have to do this. And so it's a continuous process, challenging the way we define culture, but also doing what Toni Morrison says, giving voice to that silent presence in the dark. Just to give an example of what Toni Morrison says, I never realized that until I saw that statement in Morrison. She says, take Hemingway. He's such an artist, such a craftsman of literature and English language. And she says, however, when there are black figures in his stories, even Hemingway, he makes the most horrible syntactical errors to avoid the paradox or the scandal of a spitting blood. So what he says, I heard him say that, but they never speak themselves. So what I saw is happening when they bring up these descriptions of reality, they make the others the focus. We care about them, they love them, but we're not actually listening to them. What they end up writing is the comments others make about them.
Thank you very much, Professor Gregoriou, for a very stimulating talk.